Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
And welcome. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org. Thanks, Mom. That's Mom out in the audience. You know, she couldn't get Dad off the couch. She did it last week. That was the end of it. That's her enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is the God within you. So, Sunday night. Oh, this is fall back. Everybody got an extra hour sleep, wondering where it all went to. But you got to give it up next year. That's the way it goes. Feast and famine. This is Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. And the unknown universe is shrunk down a little bit. That's the GSO. It's not the KGB, but the General Service Organization of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the auspices of the Grapevine, which is their monthly meeting in print, has produced a book on sponsorship. It's called One-on-One Sponsorship. This is a real big game changer. I believe it's huge. This is the first time this organization has produced such a work in its 78, going on 79 years of existence. So sponsorship is coming back to the forefront. Rum Radio is about one-on-one sponsorship. So we couldn't be more pleased at that idea and concept is starting to go abroad. I believe personally that sponsorship, one-on-one sponsorship, is the core foundation of all recovery programs. One person talking to another. In AA, it's one drunk talking to another. In NA, it's one drug addict talking to another. In CA, it's one cocaine addict talking to another. Someone who has the same familiarity with that particular addiction. When it comes to drugs and alcohol, I'm the type of guy, I don't see much of a difference. Alcohol was an illegal drug at one time. It is not today, but alcohol is a drug. And alcohol kills more people, I think, what is it, 250,000 die of alcohol every year. That's a lot of folks. It's 10 times more than the other, than prescription pills. So it's huge. But usually you're not going to take prescription pills without alcohol. Some do. Sometimes it's just a pill. Sometimes it's just a drug. I think really what the key is step one, which actually mentions the particular problem, disease, or affliction. So if you have a familiarity with that by experience, you can relate to the person on a level of empathy. If you have never done that particular drug or alcohol or whatever it is, you can have sympathy, but you can't have empathy because you hadn't been there. So it makes quite a bit of difference getting started. But the other 11 steps are the solution. So it really doesn't matter at that point. So the key is to work the steps. It's the, actually, I hate to bring this up, but it's the repentance program for children. And actually, AA in the big book has it better than most churches in their understanding of what repentance really is supposed to look like. Hear, hear, AA. But this is not AA. This is not NA. This is not CA. This is more like Paranoids Anonymous, where nobody will tell you where to hold the meetings, and if you can hang in the whole hour, you might think it's Narcoleptics Anonymous. No, it should have a good show tonight. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky and Alabama, and they do this for us as a public service presentation. Thanks, guys. It really helps getting the word out. Might not be the million households that you broadcast to. It might be just one guy that saves his life. And you know what? Good enough. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, who is not here tonight. He's on a plane. He was going to try to call in from the airport if it was possible. He has a convention. Oh, no, he's going to visit his grandchildren in California. His family now talks to him. He's got 25 years. He's a professional family intervention specialist. He works with troubled families. And he also goes to the prisons. With the families, he works with the fathers, the mothers, and the children, trying to get that family together. And I believe the family is the basic unit of our society. If you teach children correct principles, they can teach themselves. But until they get those correct principles and someone has taught them, they kind of just wander off. And since the parents don't have correct principles, it's becoming generational. So not only do the drugs and alcohol proliferate in the younger generation because there's no one there to teach them what's proper, moral, ethical. Nobody's home. Empty lot weed kids, latchkey kids. Still the same, hasn't changed in 20, 30 years. So now we're generational. When Harold goes to the prisons, most of the folks in prisons are about drugs and alcohol. Why drugs and alcohol? Well, it's available. Life is a vale of tears as you get older. But when you're younger, it's a party. And a lot of the kids go, hey, you had your party. You're old now. We want to have our party. We want to have our fun. I say, well, sure. You haven't been to jail yet, and you haven't had a divorce, and you haven't lost a business, and you haven't lost a house, and you haven't lost your health. Look at all the fun you're going to miss. And they look at me like, oh, yeah, that's something to consider. But you know what? I can do that tomorrow. So, Harold, thank you for all you're due for us, and I hope you have a great time with your grandchildren. So grandchildren are the jewels in an old man's crown. Tonight we have a guest. Our guest interview is Robert O. Robert O's got 15 years, and he's progressed spiritually, and he has quite the spiritual journey. Now, everybody's spiritual journey is a little different. In the big book, it says, our sobriety is contingent upon the maintenance of a daily spiritual condition. Of course, I always say, what maintains itself of itself? For the sun will extinguish in its day. So nothing really maintains itself of itself. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually. And if you're declining spiritually, your recovery and then even your sobriety becomes tentative. So we're actually required to continue to grow spiritually. And when we grow spiritually, and you can tell this because you grow in effectiveness and in understanding. If you're not doing those things, I call it restless laurelitis, resting on your laurels, talking in the meetings and not really helping anybody, pontificating, cranky. You see them all the time. Lounge lizards, we call them. They hang out at the meetings. They live in these areas. They have everything but a cot in there. They're always there. They always have something to say. And some of the things they say are really good. Some are not, but they always have something to say. But I want to say, I don't care so much what you're saying. I really care what you're doing. I believe words are only about 25% value of an action. In AA, we say the magic words are action, and more action. For faith without works is dead. I'd like to start the show tonight with the third step prayer. And the third step prayer is found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to use the Big Book because that is the template of all 12-step fellowships. This is where it all comes from. When you hear the word 12 steps, that comes from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that was first published in 1939. And then, of course, the spinoffs. We have the churches, and we have NACA, you name it, Paranoids Anonymous, Sex Anonymous, all that. But they all started with the basic text of AA. That's the template. So I used to like to do that. I start with the third step prayer, and I do this with the third because I think it's nice to get, it's a good feeling to get the spirit enlivened. That's what, it's called an invocation. You invite in the spirit. I give this as a first assignment to my sponsees. I tell them, or I suggest it, I don't, we don't tell them, but sometimes you got to give them a little strong. A suggestion is nothing more than a subtle command. The suggestion would be to get a home group. Once I've qualified the prospect, and now they become a sponsee. And there's a whole thing on Rum Radio, how to qualify your prospect, how to find the prospect, and how to find the sponsor. So we cover the base. And to get a home group, that's the first assignment, that's their lifeline group, and in that group, get names of men. I believe men with men and women with women work the best. It's easier to relate to the same gender. If that doesn't work out and you have a sponsor offered you and you can't find someone else, at least initially, and you feel comfortable with that, go for it. Work the steps. You can always get another sponsor if it's not working out. The problem with different gender is that it can... Sponsorship is very intimate. It's an intimate relationship, so it could be easily misconstrued. Why put another hoop going through the process? It's simple, but it's not easy. So no sense putting another barrier of misunderstanding that you could get in there. So that's what I believe. Same thing with gay, AA, you know, that has to be the sexual aspect of this program has to be put aside so we can work the steps. That's the goal. And then every day for the next 30 days, I want you to call one of those fellows on your list and ask them permission to recite the third step prayer. One, it gets a sponsor used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, it connects him up with that fellowship. They get to know his name and he gets to know their name. So there's a little communication going there. Third, it encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And lastly, the person he's calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol, first hit a crack, first whatever. Chances are he will not. Your sponsee's already into service work. Let's see. Come on, there we go. See if I got a call in. I see if that... Is that you, Robert?
Yes, sir. That's me. How you doing?
Good. Robert just called in. He's our interview for tonight. So we're just finishing up some of the housekeeping tonight. Harold couldn't make it. He was going to try, but he's going to go see his grandson in California. So he got a pass tonight, and he does a lot of good work. So that's fine. So if you can hold on for just a minute. We're just about to recite the third step prayer to get started.
Sure.
God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Thank you. Well, see, now that Harold usually does that, but thank you, Robert. I always like to have an amen. Well, I've been talking for about 15 minutes now, and I'm just about tired of hearing my voice. Although I had just posted something to the Rum Radio website I wanted to share with the listeners because you can't see it. It's part of it is a visual, so I'm going to give it to you. I call the post The Children of a Lesser Charge. I have a little thumbnail. It's on the website. It's a little too big. You can't get the whole picture. I got to figure out how to shrink that. Sometimes they come out big. Sometimes they come out small. I'm not the greatest when it comes to technology, but I do the best I can. It's a semicircle of AA batteries. And in the corner, there's a little poster, post-it note that says AA meeting. And then there's all the batteries. You can't see their brand. And there's one battery standing in the middle, and you can see the brand of battery. It's a Kirkland. And under the caption is, "Hi, my name is Terry, and I'm a battery." Cute, isn't it? Children of a Lesser Charge. What happens when there is an increased loss of positrons, leading to an imminent and irreversible system failure? If detected in time and have received a divine spark to get off the alkaline, get out of that alkaline. There is an AA recharging transformer stations placed in strategic locations. Is it in an open meeting? Can AAA batteries attend? Of course they can, but there'll be a slight charge. Oh, good. I need a good charge. Wait, do you take plastic? Ohm. There's a significant resistance to charging unless there's an amp pullability to send a steady stream through a wire. I wonder if he's got battered battery syndrome. No, but he does have a bipolarity with a switcho-schizo disorder. Won't he need to lose his brand if he stays there? Not if he stays ever ready and does not travel interstate. Did they bring him to energize the group then? It made them hop, skip, and then but a simple cable jump of additional cadmium ensures against a premature amateur discharge. Armature discharge. But there are C's or D's or double D's. But there are no C's, D's, or double D's. We flow with a singularity of polarity, although they too can find a trickle with a positive post of plated nickel. Double D's are considered a form of royalty as it creates an arc from a laser-focused spot on a place marked by the indentation of separation. Does it work for all batteries, regardless of their condition? We have found if there remains the smallest amount of a spark and can fit into their assigned slot in either series or in parallel circuit, an arc will generate maximum parallax effect. If so inclined, will produce a source of light. Does the discharging battery have a natural opposite pole attraction for renewal and possible survival, or does the fully charged battery take the lead in acquisition, and this in order to maintain their own needed capacity? If you don't get that, that means, does he find a sponsor or does the sponsor find him? Both. As circumstance and happenstance, as the utility of the electron flow is wired to one main power source, with several printed circuit boards. The one main power source, that's God, with several printed circuit boards, understandings, with multiple connectors, accommodating both AC and DC fields, thereby creating an unlimited interface of possibilities. How is this renewal to a former utility and the extension of a reliable, uninterrupted service accomplished? With the introduction of a 12-millimeter step-up transformer to replace medium to high voltage generators, the power becomes exponential and is of a degree not previously imagined nor conceived. For rarely have we seen a battery fail when connected to the voltage of a higher power that ensures the immunity of corrosion and a lifetime warranty of an extended service from the Copper Top Talks. Okay, Robert, that's more than enough out of me, but I'll try to do my best to keep the conversation alive and well. So tell us, what was it like, what happened, what it's like now, and what keeps you into maximum service to God and your fellows?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on this talk show radio. I love your website. I love what you're doing out there to carry the message, and all of the people, all of my sponsees, and I always encourage them to go and just kind of look and navigate to see, you know, what it is you're doing, whether it's your blog or the talk radio. So I just wanted to thank you, first of all. It's an honor to be on the show today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I have a little bit of a story before you get started again. There was a lady in my former home group, and I had run into her, it was about a year or two after starting Rum Radio, and we were at one of the local groups, Spring Branch, and she was sitting behind me, and I hadn't seen her in a very long time, and I said, "Oh, Janice, how are you doing?" She said, "Oh, I'm great." She says, "You know, I got something to tell you." I said, "Oh, please." She says, "I had moved to California for a short period of time, and while I was there, I was looking for a sponsor." She has a hard time. She's a chronic relapser, but she stays in the program in and out. Marijuana most of the time. She can't seem to stop the weed, but the program is her home kind of deal. I says, "Oh, that's great. I'm glad to see you got a sponsor." She says, "You know, when I got my sponsor in California, you know what the first thing my sponsor told me?" I says, "I don't know. What?" She said, "The first thing my sponsor wanted me to do was to go to Rum Radio." I said, "Oh,
wow."
I told her, "Oh, I know the fellow who started that." She got choked up. I mean, I got choked up a little bit, too. You know, the tears, you know, she choked up. She got a couple tears dropping out, you know, like, because it was a spiritual connection. Because what would be the chances of that happening and making full circle and then coming back to me?
Exactly. You know, and it's funny you say that story. I remember when I first came out of, when I was graduating from rehab, actually yesterday, I completed, you know, 4 years of my four-year birthday of sobriety was yesterday, and I was reflecting on, you know, I had to go to the 90 meetings, the 90 days, when I came out of rehab, and I remember hearing about or running into the cards for rumradio.org, and I remember I checked it out 4 years ago, and just the stuff on there was just, you know, there was just so much that I wisdom that I got out of it, and I was remembering that, you know, 4 years ago yesterday, and it's crazy now, and now I'm on the interview now on rumradio.org, so it's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah, well, we had started September 10th, 4 years ago, so it would be what, I can lose track, what year was that? It was 4 years ago. That was 2009, yeah, September 10th, 2009, we started Rum Radio. We posted.
Right.
It was the first time.
Right. Yeah, and my sobriety day was November 2nd. So when I came in to the rooms, there was, you know, I had your card, and people were already talking about Rum Radio. So it's kind of cool just to kind of reflect, you know, that it was that long ago. So I'm just really grateful to be on here tonight.
Oh, great. I love to hear those stories. I've accumulated some during the way. I always like to think coincidence, serendipity, and synchronicity is God incognito.
Oh, I love that. Well said.
So tell us now, what was it like? Now, you was it booze, drugs, and how old were you?
Actually, my drug of choice was cocaine, alcohol, vodka tonic, or a good scotch on the rocks, and prescription pills, anything that I could literally get my hands on. The first time that I ever tried alcohol, I drank in my early teen years. My grandfather was a local beer distributor down in the South, and local bar owner, had 40 locations. 40 different little rural areas around the area I grew up with. So, you know, here and you know, just being around that type of climate was very common to us. However, when I went into college, it was the first time that I had ever tried cocaine, but I fell in love with it. Absolutely fell in love with it.
So when you were younger, I mean, you were 40 places like that. That speaks of quite the accomplishment. I mean, you know, it's a bar. Somebody's got they run them, you know, all the time, and those are big money makers too. So you're from a wealthy family then to have that kind of resource.
Well, my grandfather started his education he started his business with a second grade education. And he built a multi-million-dollar empire with jukeboxes, pool tables, and you know, it had bars just across the South, and we were one of the only people that had a liquor license in a radius of 45 miles where there was a local college, well, a major university now, and so you know, it was a huge money maker, you know, it was a huge money maker.
Now, as a kid, you're in the bars, right? You're not drinking though, but you're around it. Did you sneak drinks while you were in there?
When I was young, actually I didn't. But what it brought to me was just I just kind of had an air of privilege. I would see my grandpa, you know, the old Patron system, the Omerta of you know all of his employees and everybody waiting on him hand and foot. And he was the godfather, and you know, I aspired to be that growing up. You know, sitting at the corner table and. You know, they're giving him his envelopes of money and they're giving him the full report, and he's sitting there with a stiff face, and you don't know what he's going to say next. So, you know, growing up, I admired that about my grandfather, just his loyalty, and he was such a man of integrity and excellence. And he never drank nor did drugs at all, but his whole business revolved around alcohol. So, growing up, going into high school, you know, I carried that. That's the air that I carried around with my friends and with my family. I was the unstoppable, the invincible, the untouchable. You know, I'd show up at my grandpa at one of the main bars, and I would just back up, and they would just fill my car with any bottles that I needed, fill up with the beer and the ice, and just signed a ticket, and there I went off, and nobody would say anything about it because I was the grandson, you know.
And you aspired eventually to be the patron, right? You wanted to be the godfather down the road, right?
I wanted to be the patron, and then I found myself drinking Patron tequila out of an Ozarka bottle 15 years later. So that's what Patron it turned into.
So you were the heir apparent? Is that it? You were the heir apparent. The prince.
Exactly. The prince of Patron. Prince of Patron.
All right, so when did you first start drinking? Now, you were in college or high school or?
Yeah, I was in high school when I first started drinking, and then I was, of course, always known as the one that had all the alcohol. I always had excess of all of that stuff because I would just, like I said, I'd go to the bars and just to the warehouse, and it would just unload, and if we were running out, the employees would bring us more and more and more until what was the wee hours of the morning. But it wasn't until college where it was just that trigger of trying cocaine for the first time. Mixed with liquor was the best combination that I thought was since sliced bread. I mean, that in college I was 18. That's when it started. That's when the engine really started.
So that was a spiritual experience then.
Absolutely. So I thought.
No, that's Carl Jung. I was looking for the exact quote, but he said that alcohol was a lower form of spirituality, that it was man's attempt to find God and medieval language, making a connection. Oh, yeah. I have it on the website. It's on the Spiritus Contra Spiritum. That was the title of his letter to Bill W., it was called Spirit in Conflict with Spirits. Yeah, so it's not unusual because, you know, we're spiritual beings anyway, and we're always trying to get that connection. You know, in every man, woman, and child is a belief of some of some kind, of something that's greater than themselves, an understanding of God. And, of course, my Harold would say, it's looking for God at the wrong address.
Wow, that's good. And then no one tells you that you get returned to sender until further notice, huh?
And nobody tells you that.
You know that, I can relate to that. It was some type of spiritual, like you said, spiritual experience, but looking for God in all the wrong places. But however, you know, you don't realize that how long that high lasts, and it was a sense of power, a sense of entitlement, a sense of control, and all I wanted to do, just have control of all of that and keep doing and doing and doing and doing and doing it, you know, and at the expense of, you know, at the expense of everybody else.
It's, I believe it's more like the, my experience is the ego, like it's self-will run riot.
Exactly. And that way with self-will run riot. Like an old friend of mine told me, he said, could perhaps your behavior serve as a warning sign for the rest of the world? And the answer was yes.
Wow, that's good. Absolutely. So, all right, so you had that going, and now you're in college, and so you found cocaine. I wish if I had the song, the cocaine song, everybody loved that song.
Wanted to hang out.
Yeah. Cocaine. And, of course, I always did, when I did cocaine, the only reason I did cocaine is because I liked the smell.
Yeah, I can really. Yeah, we started doing cocaine. You know, the college that I was going down at was right on the border of Texas and Mexico, and we had some of my cousins that were from the interior of Mexico were studying English at the university at the time, and just a lot of different family ties and family relationships that have been created, you know, decades and decades ago. You know, you kind of call on the old family friends, and you know, my son's going here, my grandson's going here to take care of him, and so we, you know, all the connections that we had made, you know, I was just hanging out with, it was the in crowd, you know, the in crowd, and just an endless pit of money. Of course, I was there, you know, draining out my savings account, where my grandparents had, you know, and my parents had worked for their whole life, you know, sitting there writing the coattails of all of my friends who I thought were my friends at the time, you know, just to look good. I mean, we take private jets down to Mexico City, Monterey, Acapulco. During the week, you know, a friend of mine had a skyscraper down there. They'd land a helicopter there. We'd charter it off into some unknown ranch down in Mexico and sit there and just in a drug pile, this huge hacienda, women all over the place, you know, food and music and it just like the movie. Nothing I had ever experienced in my life, and being high the whole time, it was just like, man, I'm on a movie. I'm kind of a big deal.
I'm in a movie.
Exactly. And so that ran out after 4 years. Of 4 years of being there in college and just funneling through everything. My brother had already graduated, and my grandfather had gotten sick, and my grandpa had gotten sick back home, and somebody needed to run the family business because my grandpa had a massive heart attack. So they packed my bags up, and I went home and started out. You know, just I wrapped it up there and left there and went up north about 4 more hours from my college town and went back into the hometown that I was born and raised in and took over the family business and started, you know, went in with a fresh vision and you know, just taking the business to the next level is what my intention on was doing it. Little did I know that was the roller coaster ride was really about to get bumpy in there.
Wow, that must have been pretty heady in charge of that a business like that. You were in charge. You were the patron.
Exactly. And my grandpa pulling the strings. He was pulling the strings from his hospital bed, if you would believe that, as a normal godfather would. He was still pulling the strings from the hospital bed, and my grandmother was the numbers guru, so she knew everything that was happening. But, you know, basically there was so much happening, and I just started opening bars left and right, and things started happening. Money was coming in, and all that while, that addiction was kept on getting stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And I was hiding it from everybody. Everyone knew I was a big drinker. I was the toast of the town. But that little bag of cocaine was always in my pocket.
Here, I found it. It's called Spirits Against the Ravages of Spirits. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. Carl Jung, or Jung, however you do it. So you could see that. I mean, you could.
I can totally relate to that.
Yeah, I didn't. And he had written that letter, and that was the title of the letter he sent to Bill W. So that's where the spirituality, how Bill realized that when he wrote the book, what he was dealing with, and of course with his spiritual experience, I believe. You know what I found, and you might find this interesting. Even though Bill W. was our chief architect, and then Dr. Bob was his co-captain or co-creator or, you know, of Alcoholics Anonymous, the people today, even though Bill had this horrendous spiritual experience, and he states it very succinctly what happened to him, and he was a good writer, so he put it all out there. A lot of folks today, and I know big book thumpers, they will dismiss, they have a tendency to dismiss that spiritual experience.
Why does that happen?
Let me put it to you this way. Ridicule is death to the ego, and the ego will sacrifice the body on the altar of pride in a vain attempt to stay alive. The preacher said, vanities of vanities, all is vanity. The definition of pride, the disavowment of God or the need thereof. It's pride. They believe that they could still do this on their own. They're still divorced from God that they don't even want to admit that there's even a possibility that there's a God. They get very agitated. And what I've realized, it was like when you shine light into a corner, it's like a shadow recoiling from the light. Not only is it uncomfortable for some people, it's painful. But we really expect at some point in your recovery that the light comes on and then you seek more light, not to stay in a flat situation. But what happens is AA, as much as they don't want to admit it, has become their church. And
exactly.
Some of these big books...
One of the things that I had to do, and you know, I say this over and over again, is that I had to realize that God was the only thing I needed until it was the only thing I had left.
Yeah. So we digress. Okay, so now you're in charge of this multi-million-dollar gin mill, and you're building it. So you're taking the platform that your grandfather put, and you're going to show him that you're going to bring this up to the next level. Of course, now you
exactly.
got that. You got the cocaine fuel going for you, so you're running on jet fuel now.
I was supercharged. Exactly, and that's what I thought. And I'll tell you that, you know, I can honestly say I had no intention of, you know, we never do, addicts never have an intention of hurting anybody. I really wanted to just to do the next right thing, and you know, I was spiritually sick. My motives were wrong. I would self will run riot, and I was fueling that cocaine addiction and fueling, you know, the sex and the pornography and the girls coming in and people just dropping at their knees whatever I needed to do, you know, to get done because of who I was. And at the end of the day, I realized, like we talked about, I was nothing but a warning sign for the rest of the world. So what happened was you put the businesses on. They were getting, they were great. They were just making money, and we were popping liquor all over the South, and you know, pop a top again, 5 o'clock somewhere, whatever you want to call it. It was just great. I mean, we monopolized all of the South. All of the South with what we were doing, and the concept that we were doing were typically old school with what my grandpa had started with, integrated a little bit of the of a younger generation, but still with an old traditional twist. So that was something that people were following us because of who we had started, who our foundation was from, and then they came because they liked the new in the kitchen. You know, they liked that we had rearranged the furniture, so to speak.
Yeah, I understand the concept. So now this is going. So okay, it's like a pendulum. You know, they the I Ching talks about progress and regress. So when something reaches its maximum, the natural tendency is regress. So you're going to reach a top like a flood. Well, what's the next level of a flood is recede. So you tell us about the top, and what was your bottom like?
Exactly. So then what happened was is that things started eventually. I started embezzling a lot of money from the business. I started pocketing a lot of money here and there. I allowed all of the local drug dealers to come in. They started infesting the places. You know, soon the Studio 54 of the South turned into a drug-infested filth trash pit for all of the local scum to come and basically just ruin the reputation of what we had built from what was initially built from the very beginning. We started getting drug raids. And of course, I was gone from that. I mean, people that were in there, our poor employees, were the ones that were caught up in that stuff. I would run. I'd be aware of. I knew what was going on. And then finally, what happened? And everything hit the fan. One of my really good friends got killed in the parking lot over a drug deal. Had to get the Halo flight came and landed on one of the main highways. I was out there, soaked out of my mind, drunk out of my mind. And I'm sitting there thinking, what am I doing here? What is happening? My friend's laying in the middle of the road dead. And there's people crying all over the place. The police are there. You know, you look around, and just kind of have like an out-of-body experience, so to speak, because I was so high. You look around, and you think, what has my life become? So, of course, my grandparents, being, you know, the enablers that they were, they never said anything. They knew everything that was going on, but they would never want to admit it exactly why we had to shut everything down and why we had to sell everything and why we had to do the things that we did. Because I single-handedly took it all down. And I admit that today. Yeah, we did that.
So that was your bottom.
Well, that was the bottom of that part. That was the bottom of that part. So I quickly packed up, left to San Antonio to work with my uncle who had an equity company there. In the meantime, left a huge mess down in Alice. And then my grandpa packaged everything up and sold it to a guy from Mexico that came and bought everything. And so that was closed. So I went and I said, I'm going to go away. I'm going to shut things down. I'm going to take some time off and just really think about what I want to do. And, you know, I didn't realize that, you know, we could pick up and go anywhere we want, but if we don't deal with the problem, which is ourselves, I could have moved 500 miles away. But when I wake up, the problem's still there because it was me. I didn't realize that. You know, step one. I didn't realize that you know, I couldn't admit that I had a problem and that it was destroying my life. So I started working with my uncle. I met a really nice girl down there in where I was. And the minute I saw her, I said, that's the girl that I'm going to marry. So got in a relationship with her, started romancing the film there, and you know, but living a lie, completely living a completely double life. I was still consuming all the pills, all the alcohol, all of the cocaine. But the face that I had was just, I was fun. I liked to play. I was alive for the party. And nobody knew that on the inside, I was completely dying. Completely just, you know, wherever I left, when I left from home and I picked up and moved to the new job, you know, my addiction was progressive. So wherever I left off, I'd go right back up.
I've had that experience with my sponsees. My experience was a little different. I hit a real hard bottom when I hit, so I had no choice. I was beaten into a state of reasonable in a very short period of time, almost overnight. My wife would say at the time, my ex-wife would say, "You're an alcoholic." I said, "No, I'm not," and she said, "You got to go." I tried therapy. The therapist said not to drink, and I go, "Oh, that's crazy." And then finally she said, "I'll tell you what." I says, "Until there's, I'm not an alcoholic." She said, "That's fine." She says, "Until there's an Assholes Anonymous, I need you to go to A&A.
Oh, wow.
So I went, and just to prove that I was not an alcoholic or a drug addict, I was going to prove that by going. And I went. I went for some time, but I didn't do anything. I came in late, left early. Didn't really – I don't even remember what the talks were about. I just – you know, it was noise, you know. There's none so deaf as those that cannot hear, you know. And so finally, there was a really bad divorce. She cleaned me out overnight. She closed my business, took my business, had the cops after me. She tried to put me in the insane asylum, so she was good. Had the cops come after me, all of it. Took all my 12 years of savings, all gone in one night.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. You know, I left when I left. We got engaged, moved to Houston. By that time, fast forward about 5 years into the business, I had started investing with my uncle, buying properties all over the state. And the woman that I was married to was a very, very wealthy, a woman as well. And so we just, you know, just kind of started living the high life. And, you know, I went into that relationship with a bunch of baggage and a bunch of secrets. And do we know that they eventually come out? And we were married. We were together for about 5 years, married for three and a half. And, you know, of course, the last 6 months of our marriage, it just got really, really bad. I was just getting really, really into pornography. The cocaine addiction had probably doubled from college. I was taking, you know, all kinds of narcotics, amphetamines. I was just taking whatever I could to fuel my addiction because I just wasn't feeling that high anymore. And we, in October, 4 years ago, we took a mini vacation down in New Orleans, and that's where the cry for help really came. You know, I went into a drunken stupor, and you know, I was just very violent. We were in a hotel room. I started throwing things, breaking things. Basically, just kind of showed the devil get the best of me, and to show what I was really made of inside. And it was just, you know, 15 years of the addiction and the lies and the secrets and the deception and the anger, the resentment, the unhappiness. All of that came out, and I literally scared the living daylights out of it. Woke up the next morning. She called and she said, I called her and she said, I took a flight back to Houston and you need to get your bags and leave the house. So I went, flew back home, got home and I said, well, this is probably going to be an overnight thing. She'll get over here in the morning. Well, the next morning, I was asked to leave. And you would have thought that in New Orleans I had already done enough, but I didn't. I went up and told a friend of mine that I went to check into a hotel room and I said, just got kicked out of the house. I'll probably go back in a couple of days, but why don't we go party? And that was when I woke up on November 2nd, 2009, in a pool of vomit and cocaine and rolled up dollar bills, rolled up $100 bills, blood all over the place, pornography blaring on the laptop. And I woke up and I said, I don't ever want to feel this way again. And
your bottom, that's your bottom. Are you on a speakerphone, perchance?
No, sir.
Okay, okay. It was coming out a little gravelly, but that's okay.
And so, so that was the rock bottom. And then from there, you know, a six-month high-profile divorce of nothing but assets and furniture and antiques and art and all of that. I lost everything. I decided that, you know, our marriage had just been consumed with nothing but material things. And I woke up one morning, I called my attorney, and I said, I don't want anything. Let her have everything. I want my clothes. I want my shoes. And I want my peace of mind. And I got my stuff. I left the house. I went to one of the best rehabs in the state. Had a spiritual awakening that I have never experienced in my life. It was actually a healthy spiritual awakening. I just knew that something alive.
What was it like? You said you had a spiritual awakening. Now, some say there's an experience, like Bill W. had an experience, which is really profound in a short period of time. Dr. Bob was more of a spiritual awakening, but that's like line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. So did you have a burning bush, or did you have an epiphany? What was it like?
I think it was when I started going back to the church that I had been attending before. I think it was when I walked into church, and I think there was a sermon about, you know, the goodness of God and the grace of God and how God's not mad at you and He's madly in love with you and the God of second chances, something that I had never heard my whole life. And something just came over me, and I realized there's no way I could feel this gratitude in my heart after everything that I've done. And I really felt, what God doesn't speak to me audibly, I just felt an impression in my spirit saying, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay if you're willing to surrender everything. And I said, I surrender all. And I can tell you, I still 4 years later, I still have experience, I still have awakening moments that are very pivotal, you know, over the years and the months and the days. And there's always something that sparks, that comes up. It's all gratitude is what it is. I think it's the gratitude and humility that I have today that I never knew existed. That I never knew what it felt like to have that.
I like to think an attitude of gratitude is a prayer unto God.
Absolutely.
Scriptures say, pray continuously. And I looked at that, you know, because in AA they ask us, you know, to pray in the morning upon awakening, that we'd be divorced from self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, and to pray that we know God's will and the power to carry that out. In the afternoon, any time we're disturbed, that we're supposed to pause when agitated and say a prayer and figure out what's going on. It's a good lunch, prayer for lunch. And then at night, upon retiring, we're supposed to do an inventory to see where we were wrong and promptly admitted it, or we need to find out if we did that, and then it's another prayer before we go to bed. So basically they're asking us any time we could pray. It's a prayer continuously. So I looked in the Bible, and it says, to keep in your heart the Psalms, which are the songs of David, in religious songs, and in thanksgiving. So an attitude of gratitude is a prayer unto God. So you're getting this.
And that's exactly what I felt. I went and I AA was a huge part of my recovery because it made me really see where I really was. And it made me realize, you know, because I think, okay, I stopped drinking and drugging. Everything's great. I'm going to conquer the world. and then I find out something called I have character defects. But oh, did that hurt?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, you don't really. It's through a glass darkly, face to face. So I believe in Corinthians. And what they're talking about is looking in a mirror. And there's a veil. The dark glass is the veil. You can't see yourself like other people see you, and you can't know yourself like other people know you. And then it says, but then. So you never get to see yourself. And then that's kind of an awakening when you start to get to see yourself. It was said in Thomas Merton, who was a Travestine monk. He's dead now. He said, if you could see yourself like other people see you, would truly be humble. And there was a French philosopher called Seurat said that if you could see yourself like other people see you, you would disappear on the spot. And Robert Burns, the plowboy poet, in Poetry to a Louse, said, if we could see ourselves like other people see us, many a foolish notion it would dispel. So that's a pretty huge thing when you're getting to see yourself. So you're getting to see yourself.
It is, and just going through that, and you know, one of the biggest things that I've found is just really, you know, when I started sowing a seed in my time of need, you know, which was, to me, was just carrying the message to others, because I thought, you know, I can't be helping other people. I still got things that I'm struggling with. And, you know, I really felt that as we take that step forward and we take that leap of faith, God stretches us. And when he stretches us, we're able to help and we're able to carry the message to others and let them know that it's okay. But also, you know, so from them, I say to some of the people, Robert, why can't I stop? And I said, because you haven't lost enough yet. You haven't hurt enough yet. And if you're not ready to stop, it's okay. You're just not ready. Nobody can force you. I had a plain grandmother, a plain mother. I went, had the best counselors. I had a great upbringing. People were telling me to stop all the time. Did I ever do it? Absolutely not. I had to do it because I had to lose everything to realize what I really wanted in life.
I know. Yeah, I've heard people practically growing up with nothing, making something of themselves. And then I've heard people coming from the best considered background. I mean, there was a fellow in there that, if you knew his name, there was multimillionaires, and the family was really well-to-do, and couldn't keep it together. Couldn't keep it together. So sometimes it's, Bill W. said, we had to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. And that means we had to become teachable. And that was about humility, which is really tough for self-will run riot.
Exactly. But then, you know, once you start experiencing that, and that's what I say even, you know, until today, you know, I am a firm believer about quality versus quantity. Granted, quantity does give you more experience, so you're able to help people at different levels because you've experienced more. But what is the quality walk of your recovery today? Are you inconveniencing yourself to help others? And if so, what are you doing about it? Do you have an attitude of gratitude? Are you teachable? You know, are you teachable? Are you willing to learn? Are you willing to step out and be of service to someone else and continue to be a trusted servant for those that need?
Yeah. So now, did you get a sponsor? Now you went to rehab. You've had this epiphany. Did you start working the steps, or how did you work your program?
I started working the steps. Of course, as you know, like step 4 and 5, it starts to really drag.
Well, 4. Actually, I believe you could do 1, 2, and 3 sitting at a traffic light, as long as you're not sitting as long as you're not in New York City. And
exactly.
The reason why New York City is because the New York City light is made up of the annoyed nanosecond, and that's what makes up a New York minute. But other than that, the first 3 steps are just an agreement. It doesn't take a lot. We drag them out, but really the rubber meets the road with step 4. And most folks stall. So on the website, exactly. I put up an abbreviated fourth and fifth step.
Exactly. And I was able to go over, you know, the steps. I had already done one. I'd done one because I had already admitted that I had a problem, that I was powerless over my addictions, that my life had become unmanageable. And then, you know, two, I did come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And then three, I made that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. So once I started with four, the inventory, that was the hardest thing, especially when my sponsor would reiterate to me that it was a fearless and searching moral inventory.
Well, my sponsor was a little kind. He said, now let's take the word fearless. That means less fear. I can deal with that one. Fearless, fearless Fosdick, I'm not quite there yet. I didn't want to do it. I basically was lazy. It took me forever to work a fourth step. It took me too many years. Now, the meetings kept me sober. I went to tons of meetings. I was addicted to the meetings. I could talk in the meetings, and there's pretty girls in the meetings, and it's funny. You know, we're not a glum lot, and there's a social interaction, and, you know, you feel comfortable. There's no judgment, or minimal. We're not supposed to, but there's usually very minimal judgment. So it's pretty heady. We start with a prayer called an invocation at a meeting. All meetings, no matter what the topic's been, are gratitude meetings. So we have an attitude of gratitude in the middle, and we end with a benediction. That's pretty heady, so I'm going to get my spiritual bump. Then I have to leave the meeting, and then tomorrow I got to come back and get my other spiritual bump. But then I got to leave the meeting, and then I come back and get another spiritual bump. And that'll keep you going and some people that'll keep them going, and that's as far as they're going to go. But until you've actually worked the steps, and you have to work the steps with a sponsor, you might be sober, but you're not in recovery. That's my experience.
That's very true because, you know, I found that a lot. I was very lucky to have a very healthy and mature sponsor that really helped me get through those steps. And not only that, when I would get sponsees, he would actually help me with those sponsees and kind of help me go through the motions with the first couple of them, and we'd go through it. But you know, it is until you work the steps, and it is until you can't. You know, the book tells us that human aid will fail you. So people would relying on their sponsors, you know, to make big decisions and to do things in their life, they realize they start making their sponsors in the meeting their higher power.
Yeah, yep, that's not the intent. Usually I tell my sponsees, I advise people never to give advice.
I like that.
I put it on the website, Decision Making for Dummies, and I direct them to that. It's a spiritual concept of making a decision, but they have to make their own decisions, good, bad, or indifferent. I can't make that decision for them. They said, well, what if you were me? What would you do? I said, well, I'm not you. You're going to have to make that decision. Well, my job is to get you through the steps in a timely manner, you know, so as much as I can. I'm more into the timely, let's get a moving. Because you really don't learn the steps until you teach the steps, until you're the sponsor taking the next guy through. You know, now you're really starting to understand the steps. When you go to the first time, it's sort of like a kid in Toyland kind of deal. You know, you don't really see it. But when you're putting someone else through and explaining it to them, the sponsor, early sponsor, is learning more than the sponsee. So I have people that they don't want to sponsor. So I said, yep. I says, you know what? You're going to make mistakes. Welcome, you're human. The way you get to be a good sponsor is you got to sponsor. 20% of the people are doing 80% of the work. And that, I think, is a failing of today because we're counting on the meetings to be recovery and not the steps with the sponsor. But that's why I did Rum Radio, is to get you going on sponsorship. Now, there's no excuse. Here's a platform of understanding. You don't have to use any of it. You could use all of it. Take the tools you need, but now there's a place to find the tools to help you sponsor the next sufferer. So I believe that's huge. If that's the whole thing started, Bill talking to Dr. Bob had 18 days when him and Bill went to Akron Hospital. I always get that wrong. They went to Akron Hospital and they talked to Bill D, who was a lawyer. And so that was 4 years before the publication of the big book. And then anytime you see the icon, Man on the Bed, there's a book in the fella in the foreground. He's got a book. You know what book that was? It was the Bible.
Yeah, it is.
The people don't realize that was 4 years before the publication of the big book. So that was the Bible. That's usually the only book they'll let you bring into the hospital. So we had Dr. Bob, 18 days sober. Bill W. had about 6 months at that point. And then Bill D. was a lawyer. So we had, and you know, of course, Bill W. is the chief architect of AA. So look at the cast of characters. We had a doctor, a lawyer, and an Indian chief. And that's what started AA. Thank you.
That's powerful stuff.
So, okay, so you had a good sponsor. Lucky you. Some folks don't know what they're doing, and they'll agree to be your sponsor. They haven't got a clue what to do. And, of course, they're going to, you know, Bill W. said, a good sponsor can mean the difference between life and death. A lot of folks miss that. A bad sponsor is a killer. Make no mistake. If the guy agrees and he don't know what he's doing, he has the tendency he could kill somebody. But they'll agree anyway. But they haven't got a clue what they're doing. It's a shame, but that's the way it's not a perfect world. All we can do is give the information and pray that they take it. So you had a good sponsor. So that's a heads up. All right, so you got the sponsor, you did the steps. You did step five, so was that another spiritual bump?
It was. It was all a spiritual bump. You know, and I can say I know I had a spiritual awakening with each of the steps that I did because it was just a reassurance that I knew that I was going in the right direction, whether it was the good orderly direction or was it true, was it God the creator of the universe? And for me, it was God the creator of the universe. And I realized that he was directing my steps and that I was not in control and that when I would put my head on the pillow at night, if I knew I did the right thing and everything that I could do and reflect on the things that I could do better, you know, whether it was did someone deserve an apology, if I resentful of somebody, and I still today do the daily inventory and the daily reprieve in the morning, and it's amazing. But the best thing out of all of it was doing, giving back, carrying the message. That's 12. And that's what I do
today. The one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. Intensive work, that means sponsorship. This activity works when other activities fail. That's the basic. That's the simple, basic direction. That's why we're in business. This is all we're supposed to do. We're in business to help the new sufferer. I'll put it to you this way. The newcomer's life's blood to AA, just like the old-timer's the backbone. But the newcomer, relapse is the soul because there's nothing so tormented as a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. So if I'm not in charge, God's in charge, so I get them to the steps quickly. If I accomplish anything, what I've done is I've ruined their drinking and drugging career forever. They're never going to drink and drug again with impunity. And that's the job of the sponsor, and get them to God. As soon as quickly as possible, you get them to God. Now, God will handle it. You got to let it go. There you go. I did the next right thing, and God takes the reins.
Exactly. That's exactly how I feel, and I'm just grateful. I just, that attitude of gratitude that I can give back, and I, just really can humble myself every day and just really seek God into where does he want to use me, and how can I continue to be teachable, and how can I inconvenience myself today to help someone else, and that's how I live my life today, and I couldn't be happier. I couldn't be happier.
How about step nine? Did you have any trouble with the amend step?
Actually, I did. The funny thing with the step nine was the amends I had made to some people weren't even mad at me. And they didn't even know I was mad at them. They said, what are you talking about? It was the funniest thing. One guy I hadn't talked to in 5 years. I thought he was mad at me for some reason, so I thought I'd cut him off. And when I called him, he said, well, I knew you were in your addiction crap, and I knew you were doing your thing, so I didn't want to bother you, but I'm not mad at you, bro. You don't owe me an apology.
You know, I like the one thing in the big book, which is really hard to swallow, and I try to get this instilled in my sponsee's head, that we ask for forgiveness even when the fault is elsewhere. Wow. That's a bite. That's a spiritual bite. It takes a lot of humility to admit you were wrong when you were right, because being right to an alcoholic or a drug addict could mean dead right.
Exactly, and don't mess with me if you can't agree with me.
Yeah, that's the ego again. So okay, so now you do the 10, 11, and 12. You do those on a regular basis. Is that part of your growth?
Absolutely, it is. I continue. I take the personal inventory daily, and I can always look back at the end of the day and actually in the moment sometimes, you know, when I'm wrong, I probably admit it. And I'll apologize to someone for my actions, and then, you know, then I move on. And then I continue to seek through prayer and meditation to improve my quality walk with God, praying for discernment, praying for just the wisdom to help others and to continue to help myself.
That's great. Okay, now you have a ministry that you're giving back on. Now you're doing AA, or you're doing a religious or a Jesus directed ministry using the 12 steps. What are you doing now to give back?
To give back, I still go when I have time to go to the AA meetings. I'll go to a few meetings here and there, but I'll do sober recovery. And basically what I'm doing is just waiting for the people to call, and people need help, I'm up and I'm on the way out.
You know, the big book actually says, and that's what I really try to pound in, they say in the meetings, you know, does anybody need to, if you're available to sponsor, raise your hand. But the big book says in two different places, go find a prospect and start working on them. And it's asking the sponsor, which makes all the sense in the world, that's asking the battery that's already fully charged to go out and look for the guy that's losing his charge, which makes sense. You know, it doesn't ask for the ill person to find out, to know the jargon, the culture, and the lay of the land, coming in off the street, but that's the way we do it now. Also, it says if the person's not interested, it's okay. Don't go find someone else who's desperate enough to want what you have.
Exactly.
And nobody does that. I don't, you know, and that we're so ingrained with this, you know, and that's the rehab stuff that everybody complains about, but when you point out what it is, it's so ingrained. They don't like it. You know, and I go, hopefully there's a change coming around. Rum Radio's part of it, and there's a lot of other areas. Clancy noticed that he made a statement about it, that some areas are really starting to push sponsorship big time. And those are the areas where AA is growing again.
Exactly. And like I said, you know, it's such an honor to, and I'm just so humbled to be on this talk show. And it is so great to see what you're doing as a trusted servant. Just, you know, in all around, you know, all aspects, you know, you don't represent one religion or one organization. You're for everybody, and you're pushing the people to do the next right thing and to be aware of the things around them and the things of how can they continue to do the next right thing with guiding principles, guiding, you know, their moral compass. And I love that, and I love what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Robert. I know you're winded down, and I pushed it a little longer than I was planning. I'll tell you this, though. Mark Twain said, if you always do the next right thing, you will surprise some and amaze the rest.
I'll give you an amen on
Amen on that. Well, thank you so much for your story. Was there anything else that you wanted to get out, or anything about your ministry or anything like that?
No, I just want to encourage the listeners just to, you know, not to give up and to continue to, you know, you do two things that what I learned is, one, to be honest, and two, to ask for help. You can never go wrong with that. I just want to encourage them to get into a good base recovery program, email you on, you know, Rum Radio, get into a good Bible-based church, you know, figure out what it is that you want in your life and ask somebody for help. There's always somebody willing to help when you least expect it.
Thank you. Great words of wisdom. Thank you so much. I know you. If the listeners are listening, Robert had he's got a really bad cold, and he's just about wound out. He's running out of gasoline about 10 minutes ago, and he hung in there. So thank you so much for this opportunity. I know this has helped somebody out there.
Thank you so much, Joseph. It was an honor. We'll talk soon.
Sure, you bet.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. In closing, we like to say Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi. We're in 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 3 and 400,000 hits to the website. It's taking a little over 4 years, but we're out there, folks. If you want us, it's a click and a rumradio.org. It's a point and a click, and there's a ton of information that you could find. Now, we use the big book and the 12 and 12, and that's, we figured out that we have some other program literature, but we keep it to the program. It's spiritual, it's humorous, and it's informative. Yay! So remember, and we're very popular in Nepal. You know why we're popular in Nepal? They like our yak. So remember, the next time you're looking for sponsorship information, it's rumradio.org. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.